First, I would like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me and allowing me to talk. So today, especially for allowing me to talk about some topic that seems to be more suitable for the other program. But anyway, so today I'm going to talk about something related to tensor networks and its relation to this ADS-CFT duality. So let me briefly give a review and the motivation of what I'm going to talk about. Before that, this is a work in collaboration with Zhao Yang, my student, and Patrick Hayden. It's ongoing. I'm just going to be saying things very briefly and review the background. Basically, we have a CFT duality, and very vaguely, I'd like to say it means we have a QRP, which is not necessarily mean the continuous field theory. It means the general quantum many body system is due to geometry. So I won't specify more things. And it's, in general, it's something geometrical, something about gravity is mapped to properties of a quantum many body system without gravity in it. And then starting from the RT formula that tells us, okay, there is a quantum entanglement part of the duality with the entropy, the entanglement entropy of some regime is proportional to the area of the corresponding geodesic. So there is a regime and then the area of the geodesic surface is something like that. And these two are proportional. And that observation motivates all these works about trying to relate this duality to tensor network states. And these are all trying to like make or give a macroscopic interpretation of that formula and other related physics of the ADS-CFT. So I'm going to list several of the different tensor networks which motivate the work I'm going to talk about. So of course, it starts with this MERA, this multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz proposed by Yu-Jui et al. And then it was first studied by Brian Swingle to propose that this is related to the ADS-CFT, and I won't list very many more recent progress. And basically, what this is ansatz, which means it's a state defined by contracting tensors. So, for example, I can draw one. Just draw some very coarse-grained picture. So, so you just put some tensors on every point, and you contract all these tensors, and then this becomes a big tensor as a function of these indices. And so you think this as a wave function, which is labeled by the spins on every side, and so on. So this is a definition of a state. And it has the nice property that the entropy is bounded by some area of the geodesic surface. The shortest cut between two determines how much, at most, how much entropy you can have between two parts of the system. So
you're thinking of the number of indices being bounded by some fixed number.
Yeah, it's basically saying like you can cut the network anywhere you want, and then this gives you like a decomposition of the wave function. which is sum over all the indices at the cut of one state of this region and the other state of the complement region. And this is not necessarily a orthogonal basis, but whether or not it's orthogonal, this already bound the rank of density matrix, so it bound the energy. And then you choose the shortest cut, which gives you the tightest bound. Okay, so then one related approach I want to mention is what I defined in 2 years ago, what I call the exact holographic mapping. I realize it's maybe not so good a name. So what I want to say is, someone said maybe entanglement holographic mapping. So I want to use almost the same picture, but now view this as a unitary map, which means that look at these tensors, and you can think so if you draw some arrows, it's like a map from these two legs to these two, some maps to these two, and then there are two legs which map to one. And so you can think this as there is another leg going out to the block, but going out of the plane. And if I draw this picture, there will be four legs going out here. In general, it's like these red points are going out of the plane everywhere in the block. So in MIRA, this ansatz state, you can write it in a way that it's a unitary map, which is the reverse of that mapping, which is the reverse of the arrow I draw. It's a unitary map acting on a product state. So it's like I put a spin up at every point here. And then the product of them, you apply a unitary mapping that maps them back to the boundary. So in general, you define a mapping from a product state to some state that's highly entangled. So I would like to use this idea of the fact that there's a mapping, that this kind of unitary circuit is a mapping rather than just defining an ansatz state. This M is from block to boundary. So I want to define a unitary mapping by this circuit. So this circuit defines the mapping rather than a particular state. And then now to relate this to geometry, because I'm allowing general states in the bulk, I have some more thing I can play with, which is I have dynamics in the bulk. Because I'm not restricted to product states, so I can talk about dynamics, correlation functions, these kind of things in the bulk. So bulk operators, dynamics, and so on. And then in particular, I want to relate it to geometry. So I want to say, for any 2 points in the bulk, I want to propose you calculate the neutral information for the given state, and use that as a measure of geometry. You define the geometry by a function of the neutral information. So I won't go to any detail of that, but this is what I'm going to discuss today is a modified version of this, but it's still a unitary mapping. So what we would like is there is a unitary mapping so that every property of this system is mapped to something there.
So we're not picking a state on either side?
Right.
So the mutual information in what state then?
So different states will correspond to different geometry. So for a given state, you get a geometry. Okay, I give you the ground state, you get some EDS geometry, and if I input a mixed state, which is a thermal ensemble, you see the geometry has changed by calculating the information, and it looks more like a black hole. That's exactly the motivation of doing this, that because in general, I don't know how many ways of redrawing the network there are, so instead of redrawing the network for every given geometry, for a given network, I can define different geometry. But the choice of the mapping is, of course, it's like a choice of background geometry that is not a priori determined. So
So you think of the different states you can put into the red arrows as some perturbative fields around the fixed background.
So I would like to think, okay, so it's assuming there is a system where mirror is exact, that would be the case where the box states are really not entangled. And then the more general case is they are short range entangled.
But I mean, in the case where it's unitary, though, you can get any state by feeding stuff into the red legs, so they can't really all correspond to both.
No, but there's excitations. Wait, so there's two different kinds of states for the red legs. There's the ones like you wrote, and then there's general states.
For the ones like you wrote,
you just get zero, right?
You can have perturbative excitations that are in superpositions, right? So I mean, you can have arbitrary quantum states in the fields living on the
background. Some of the legs of the unitary are contracted within the network. The legs that are coming out are only a few legs. So it's not really a...
The number of legs is the same as the number of
Yeah, in the original way of thinking about this, the number of legs is equal.
Because I'm going to talk about something... I mean, what I'm going to talk about will not depend on detail of this formula. So let me skip the detail of that. But I want to mention, so there is one problem of this approach. Pointed out by Daniel to me, I think that this is a unitary mapping. So if I think about an operator here, it corresponds to some operator on the boundary, which is a concrete one, a unique one, that's here, living on these four sets. As a general mapping or RG scheme, that would be okay. But if we want to compare with ABS-CFT, it doesn't have the nice symmetry. It means that if you give me a box point, instead of having a special boundary condition corresponding to that point, I should have a family of them related by some symmetry that preserve that point. So we would like some property that this correspondence between the box operator and the operator on the boundary is not that explicit one-to-one. And that's nicely shown in this the third kind of tensor network I'm going to mention, which is this what do I call it? This work of Aspolsky. This work of the happy group. You have probably heard their talks and. They talk about a tensor network that has a structure that's slightly different from this, which is a parabolic tiling, so it's more symmetric in some sense, but it's but the important thing is that what are the tensors. So for example, if you draw a tensor network like this, I don't know how to draw them, but so you have a parabolic tiling where every tensor is the same. But the key thing that different from the general other tensor network is this tensor has a perfect tensor condition, which means there is you pick any even number of legs, you pick any three legs to any other three legs, it's a unitary map. If you pick a different choice, you use these as input and these as output, it's still a unitary map. So you pick any 3-3 as a unitary map. So because of that, they have this nice error correction property that, I haven't gone down the code yet. So to talk about the box operators, you need a different network which looks similar to this, but you need this kind of bulk error. Right? So they have two different proposals in this work that one is holographic state. Which is a state. So you think that as like a more like a mirror-like state, but it has a nice property that it satisfies RP formula exactly rather than as a bound. And then there is the other thing, which is the holographic code, which means say I can use something like pentagon tiling, but there is a one arrow going out of the plane. So then this thing is like that, but the number of bulk legs is smaller than the boundary. So this is an isometry from boundary to bulk. And that isometry has these properties that I have multiple boundary operators which are mapped to the log, mapped to the same operator in the log. So this is an isometry. And this isometry is defined from a smaller space here in this direction to a bigger space here. Okay, what I want to talk about today is I want to combine the features of these different approaches and define a unitary mapping define a completely unitary mapping which in a low energy subspace still have the nice properties of the holographic state and the holographic code. So that's the motivation. And it turns out that's also related to another question, which is how to think about a tensor network that's in a sub-ADS scale or in the flat space. So let me go to the definition of my new tensor network. I don't have a name, right? So the definition of the tensor network is this: I want to define a tensor. Let me just define it like this. Okay. So it's something like it has four legs in plane. You can probably easily generalize it to six legs and so on. A leg is the even, and then this leg is the bulk leg. Let me label them like this. So this tensor has several properties, three properties. Property one, actually, alpha, this alpha beta gamma delta goes from 1 to d, and this I, this bulk index, goes from 1 to d to the fourth. So property one is very simple or almost trivial, which is that it's a unitary mapping from alpha beta gamma delta to 1. So let me draw this diagram. So this already guaranteed that I can use this to combine to make any tensor network. I can connect them in any way, connecting these legs in any way. It's guaranteed that it's an isometry from boundary to fault.
Is that unitary or an isometry?
This is unitary. B to the four to B to the four.
Okay.
So this, like for example, I can connect them. And basically, I can draw a 1D example. Like I have this my box space, and then I have boundary space like this. So you can draw any tensor network like this, and basically you can think of them as a unitary map from all the white legs to the red, and then you contract with the 1-1. So after the contraction, it's still an isometry from the remaining legs to the one. So if it's just like that, it will be kind of too general to be interesting. But it gives some nice, very big Hilbert space where you can, it's auxiliary space where you can play or define a few things. And there are two other conditions which are more than trivial, which is defined in a subspace. So there is a piece of the four dimensional space of the box qubit. And then let's define a D squared dimensional subspace of the piece of the four dimensional space. And the property of this tensor with the n in the subspace is that number two condition is if I fix that index to be one of the values and view this as a four-leg tensor, it's perfect. Which means this is unitary, and you can choose any other arrow drawing, and it's also unitary.
Is this a basis-dependent statement of the
yes,
base
word? Yes, exactly. The superposition of them would not be perfect. But the key point is, of course, you can find the one state set by this. You just put that stabilizer, you put that perfect tensor in there. But the natural statement is that you can do this for n square space for all d square space set in that. But that's also not so hard. It's easy because you can locally do some like outside unitaries which doesn't change the perfect condition. And as long as you get a thousand states, you're okay. What makes it more natural is
so it's not a subspace. That's what Aaron says. It's not a d square like dimensional every, subspace.
It's not like every state in a subspace satisfies this condition. It's just that d square space.
Are they orthogonal to each other?
They're orthogonal. So that's in the third condition. The third condition is they are not only orthogonal, they are even there is an even stronger condition that if I choose any one of the four as input together with the red line, no, I'm not fixing this, I'm thinking this as a map from these two to the other three. So you count the dimension, this is d squared with the d. This is unitary. Or any choice of the four.
I thought that was guaranteed by number one, I thought, actually.
Number one? No. Number one is...
Oh, sorry, you that guarantees it's an isometry.
Right, number one guarantees this way is an isometry. Into that big...
But
now I'm picking this smaller subspace. In a smaller subspace, there's a unitary mapping these two legs to the three.
I want to think of that like a six-leg perfect tensor.
It's slightly weaker than the six-leg perfect. If you think these two, these are two legs, then this is part of the perfect tensor. So this guarantee... So okay, now if I write explicitly what is this condition, it's you contract these three labs. And this is equal to a direct function. All right, so that's the requirement. Okay, so...
That's an additional requirement?
That's an additional requirement. The number two doesn't give you that.
Oh, that's so, part of three. It's the same...
This is unitary. This is the same as saying it's unitary. This is just saying that times this diagram.
I think there are two classes of these vertices. One has a d to the fourth dimensional extra leg, and the other is
extra. No. D to the 4 and the D. Every white line is D.
No, sorry. But the top, in case 2 and case 1, it looks
not
as so it's a D squared dimensional index, but the condition 2 and 3 is true for a subset of that D to the 4. So I have D to the 4 basis here, but only D squared of them will satisfy this.
Oh, just that there exists a subspace?
But it's not true for every vector in that subspace. It's saying that you can choose a basis for the d to the 4 dimensional space, where d squared of them satisfy this condition.
Yeah. The last one is a subspace condition, right? Presumably.
Okay. So that last thing the same as saying it's unitary? I don't see it.
He's just writing u dagger u equals.
Oh, but I don't see the dagger bit. Is there?
Well, I'm just defining this to be changing the arrow. The arrow is the dagger. So it's just a picture. This condition is this perfect for fixed index. This is saying it's unitary if you
have
fixed
the dagger.
I won't go to the details of like what tensor satisfies this condition because of timing. There are two things I can say. One is we have explicitly found such tensors. So these tensors do exist.
For any d, or
I didn't prove it exists for any d. But I numerically find that, and I found that for d equals 3. So you don't really need a large d for that. D equals 3, q shift, you can't do this.
Is it like perfect tensors isn't the statement for arbitrarily large d, but not necessarily for any d?
And another thing I want to mention is there is some intuition why it is a natural requirement. The intuition is, we know the intuition, we know the perfect tensor is like a particularly good example of a random state, right? So if you take a very large system and take a random state in it, then are added into four parts. It's more, almost like a perfect tensor due to predicate. But if you think of like random Hamiltonian, take two eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, you take a random chaotic Hamiltonian, it has many eigenstates. Each of them is like this, except the one that has very low energy. So there are many states which each of them is perfect. And they are orthogonal to each other, of course. But not only they are orthogonal to each other, they satisfy this kind of condition. Why? Because this condition is equivalent to the statement that I take any operator acting on this lag. I take any single set operator acting on this, called X. Then, now this looks like an inner product of two states. So it's like state N, just put the N here, put an X acting on the first side, and identity acting on the other side. And this is another M. And the statement is that this is zero for all N and M are not the same. So this is the if anomaly. If this is true for every X, then that means you can just open that back and that's a unique. But that condition is exactly what we talked about in eigenstate thermalization. It means that not only like each state looks random and the subregions are maximally entangled, like you cannot have an operator that acts on a subregion smaller than half of the system and have an optimal value between the two states. I mean, it's only approximately true in thermalization case, but here it's exactly true. So, but the intuition is it's true for random states.
Does eight-leg perfect tensor satisfy this condition?
Why eight-leg? I don't think it's guaranteed to satisfy. Like, if you take an eight-leg perfect tensor like this and then this, it's guaranteed. Like, if you choose these two and these are the inputs, these are outputs, then it's unitary. But if you fix these two a state, it's not unitary. In general. Okay. So why do I want to define this thing? Let's discuss two kind of properties of tensor networks made by these tensors. Sorry. So the first property is the property of the big Hilbert space. And then we will discuss more properties in the smaller subspace when you choose this to be one of the D square. So the property of the entire space let's say we make a tensor network of these tensors. Whatever it is. Actually, let me just, for simplicity, let me just draw a flat one. So we make a tensor network with these tensors, with the outgoing lines. And as I said, because each of them is already a unitary from the white one to the red one, the whole thing just looks like a unitary from all the red legs to all the white legs. And then you connect the sum of them. So what you are left with is a subspace of all the white ones. So some subspace of them. So there is an isometry from this smaller number of lines to that bigger number of lines.
Okay, so schematically, let me draw.
You mean the subspace of the red line? Right.
Yeah. Schematically, we can draw something like. There is a map from the smaller space, which is the space of the boundary legs, which I call HP. So that's what I think are physical states. To this much bigger box space, if I use a big grid in the flat space, then it's much bigger. This box one is much bigger. But that's what I think are not physical, the auxiliary big Hilbert space. So what does this state, what's the property of that state? The key property of this map is there is a gauge symmetry in the bulk, which means I can do something in the bulk which doesn't change anything on the boundary. And that gauge symmetry is simply defined by I can find operators, say I call W. W is labeled by four unitaries. Each G1, G2, G3, G4 are unitaries acting on the D-dimensional space, SUV. And this W is defined by W act on there is equal to acting G. Acting G1, G2, G3, G4 on each leg. So I can always do that because the whole thing is unitary. So I can find the W that says that. So then all the gauge transformations that preserve the boundary state are simply done by you pick a G for every bound that doesn't connect the boundary. So I can multiply basically, let me draw a bigger one. I can, for any bound like this, which doesn't connect the boundary, I can multiply G here and the G inverse, and then say, like, do that everywhere. And then, that of course doesn't change anything on the boundary. But when you put this to a W, this is telling you a symmetry of the bulk state. And this is telling you a bulk, so any state of the red light under the state acted by W correspond to the same boundary. So that's the property of that map. And that's a good property because it tells me like the bulk, like this big hyperspace which looks local is not physical. In addition, this is a little different from the ordinary gauge symmetry we talked about in PAPS, like in Torrey code, like it may reduce the degrees of freedom, but you may still have local degrees of freedom. But this one is this is such a big gauge symmetry that you actually don't have any local degrees of freedom. Because for any site like this, as long as it's not directly neighboring the boundary, you can prove using this symmetry that any local operator has trivial average value. Because if I have a local operator, then because of the gauge symmetry, so I cannot distinguish this operator with W dagger of W. So the operator that has a non-zero average value has to be invariant in W. The W is not the whole SUD to the 4, but it's SUD times SUD times SUD times SUD, and there is no fixed point. So there is no operator that's invariant in that. Is this clear? And there is a simpler way to see that because you can just trace over all these red sites here. You take this state and think there's like a state for the red line, and you trace over the red line around it. And that will completely decouple the interior response. Because this tensor is unitary, so if you take this and conjugate. This is the square function of the short line.
So the W symmetry leaves that D squared subspace on it, maps it to itself, or it rotates it arbitrarily.
It rotates it arbitrarily
into the force.
In general, it rotates it arbitrarily, but otherwise the projection to that space will be an invariant operator. There's no invariant operator. So in general, it will project it to rotate to arbitrary other spaces, but these two properties are preserved. Because W is equivalent to doing GG on the four legs, which doesn't change these two conditions. So actually, the vector that sets by these are like orbits. So what does this mean? This means that if you look at this big D to the fourth space on every point, this gauging symmetry tells you all the gauging invariant operators that are non-trivial, acting on the boundary Hilbert space, must be defined in the region that bound the boundary. It's defined like I can pick these points and define some operator acting on them, then that's non-trivial or anything. So if you can draw any region that bounds the boundary, and that's where the non-trivial operators exist. I think that this gauging symmetry is sort of like a counterpart of general, the counterpart of Dilly morphism in this toy model. And it's saying that all the operators in the bulk, which has an actual corresponding boundary operator, has to be defined by choosing a frame, and that frame has to be defined in at least in a wedge which bound the boundary. With some kicker.
Can you take any operator that's within this thing that you drew and do a gauge transformation that reduces it to, let's say, just those two boundary ones that are closest to the boundary?
I think so.
So you can push anything just all the way to the boundary?
I think that you can. If you don't think of anything about that smaller space, you do it everything in the bigger space. You can push everything to the neighbor to here. I think that's enough already. Because the diffusion here is like equivalent to the four lines here, which include these two as a subspace. So if you just look at this, it's kind of trivial. It's saying that you have an option. You have an option of pushing everything to the boundary, which is like you have an option and don't do anything. You have the different choices, and one of the choices is doing trivial thing. And then there are like restricting to this or any subspace is another option. It is more natural.
Those are two different, I mean, those would be like two different theories, right? Or were you trying to say that somehow that the...
Well, they are like different gauge choices. I mean, because I can define an assumption already from the boundary to the first layer in the box. That's already enough information. So if you have any boundary theory with a Hamiltonian or something, then that's saying that this already gives you a complete description. So if you go to the lonely subset, there's another description. So they must be equivalent. But it's just different between you choose the duality or you don't.
I mean, do you think that this gauge symmetry is sort of roughly corresponds to Diffeo morphisms, or it's much bigger than Diffeo morphisms? This seems to include a lot more than just the Diffeo morphisms.
Well, I haven't seen any other symmetries, so I think it's a counterpart of the Diffeomorphism, but I don't know.
For example, just by doing Diffeo morphisms, it's not so clear. We can just move everything out to the boundary and so on. Right, I mean.
I'm not sure.
Why not?
What is the counterpart?
You can just make coordinate transformation that pushes everything so it looks like it's close to the boundary.
yeah, but you're right, I guess.
It's basically saying if you only look at the physics at a slice, that at a space-time slice, that's close to the boundary, that's presumably contained everything on it.
For example, there are things like the geodesic distance between two points that should be preserved by the geomorphisms, and I guess it's not so obvious here.
Only when you go to the boundary. I don't think you can.
I think you should think as well.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so you choose some coordinate chart, and then those are those tensors, and then as Matt said, you just, you know, all the action is happening in the boundary. You just take the ordinary ideas and you just put it in some coordinates.
Put crazy coordinates.
Yeah.
I think I agree with Daniel that it sounds like it contains the transformations that maps a boundary CRT to some theory that lives in the whole ball.
Yeah.
So this doesn't sound like a Diffeo morphism. Maybe it contains. Yeah, it contains the duality itself as a.
Yes. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's super Diffeo morphism. Thank you.
So let's in the remaining 20 minutes, let me talk about the properties of the low energy subspace. So that entire space basically set a platform. Like everything happens in that big space. It just makes me feel better that we didn't lose any space. But then the interesting states, which says that there's like an I formula and so on, these are in the low energy subspace. And okay, so what are their properties? So now this discussion has nothing to do with what the structure of the network, but the low energy substrate, because it has these perfect tensor properties, as we already learned from the happy paper, it's some property that you have an energy formula depends on the structure of the network.
So low energy substrate, you mean just some d square?
Yeah, just restricted every point to d square rather than all the d to the fourth. So we can think of a network like okay, so if I'm thinking of ADS, then what are the network I can think about? Then let me draw the dual lattice just to be simpler. I can okay, so I can draw something like that. So it's a tiling with squares. And then this is the dual lattice. So in every square, I have a tensor. I'm only going to draw. Okay, so this is one possible configuration that we consider. And there is this going on. But I'm not restricted to that because now I have four legs in plane. So instead of considering a tiling which is hyperbolic, I can consider a sub-ADS thing because I can replace every tensor by a lot of them like this. So I can make that as refined as possible. And then there is one red point at every. Okay, so what is the property of these kind of tensors? Number one property is what we already know from the conclusion of this paper, that as long as there is no positive curvature, like this one doesn't have a positive curvature, the dual lattice of this is apartheid, and there is no, like, I think that the definition is geodesic. There is no local minima, which is like some line. There is only one sharpest geodesic, and when you go from here to here, you didn't get stuck at some local minima. So I think because this is true for the flat space, so I think there is no problem going from ADS tiling, from a hyperbolic space tiling, to like very refined continuum limit.
So let's talk about one boundary interval.
So I will talk about the multi-interval. So single interval RT formula. That's true as long as there are two conditions. One is the bulk state is the product state. So I'm taking it doesn't matter what which one of the d square, I can choose any of the two to the n choices. And for a fixed product state, then there is this property that is a perfect tensor in plane. So this is the holographic state. So this and then non-positive curvature. So as long as these two conditions are satisfied, there is RT formula. So that's why I want to identify these states as low energy subspace. We didn't have a Hamiltonian, we don't talk about energy, but these are the states that has not too big internal.
Wait, this one has a subspace. I thought this one had a subspace.
This is not a subspace. It spans some subspace.
So you're gonna call the low energy anything that's spanned by this?
I would like to think anything that spans by that as a low energy subspace, but I'm not sure if they all have nice entanglement properties.
Right. So in ordinary ADS CFT, we think of a low energy subspace as maybe quantum fields on ADS, mm-hmm. and a quantum state, which is a product of you know states and lots of each little region, is not going to be a low energy state, right?
That's right.
Tends to have very high energy.
Yeah.
So how important, and you said that the bulk state has to be at this product state?
I think that, okay, so this is how I, what I want to compare with the low energy of the ADS, continuous ADS space field theory is, so let's take all n equal to zero, let's say that's the lowest energy ground state, it has satisfied the Italian energy and all these things. So zero equals to product of zero on this side. So this, once you take that, this is determining the state, right? So that state is called ground state. And then I can define like single spin flip operators. I can define operators acting on these points to flip them to other places. And I would like to think, so say I have an operator acting on a certain site, well, keeping all other sites at zero. So I want to compare that with like the field operator in the book. So it's not like, yeah, don't think this as literally the product state in the bulk, because the field theory vacuum will not have trivial incoming entropy. And this is just some basis, like the incoming entropy of the field theory is already in that tensor somehow. But the activations are.
Gary's right, though, that if you computed, say, the two-point function of that phi in that state, it would be zero.
Yeah.
Connected
yes.
two-point function.
I think there's a better answer to Gary's question, which is that even in the continuum, we expect Ryutaki-Nagi to have these FLM corrections coming from a bulk entanglement piece, but it happens to be subleading in N compared to the area piece. So by just considering product states, you're just considering a state where you don't worry about this bulk entanglement entropy, but I think it will be a part of the correct story.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, probably in the end, so the reason we didn't have to worry about this is because we were just at the ADS scale, so then the bulk entanglement is all exponentially small. But when you want to look at sub-ADS distances and really, well, you even there, I mean, you, in the end, you probably want to feed in some state with some entanglement into these bulk loads and call that the ground state. I mean, in the end, that's probably what you want to do.
Yeah, I agree. So basically, yeah, the picture is that this is like an ansatz. This is a toy model. So this is the, say, I call it the ground state of that toy model. And what it may look more like the true ground state should be a short-range entangled state of these qubits. But the entanglement between them should be small compared to that Ryutaki-Nagi.
Well, actually, in the ADS, for the sub-ADS scale stuff, though, it shouldn't even be short range. It should be long range entanglement because there could be massless fields involved.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the graviton.
Yeah. Okay, so it's only required to be short range in the scale bigger than ADS.
Yeah, that's right.
But what you want to require is like within each of that thing. So within. Within each, so this is like ADS scale, and then what you want is these qubits in that region are not too entangled with qubits here. So when you look at the entanglement between say this region and the rest of the system, it's mainly by this length, which gives you an area, but it's not mainly by.
So the density, it's a Planck density.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is. Because my state is defined on the boundary, so the key point I want to talk about the ADS sub-ADS scale locality is these states, like there are many states like this, or you think about operators that act within that space, they in low density looks independent to each other, but when you go to high density, of course they are not. Right? If you have too many of them, then of course there are some operators that you map to zero. Because I can make this very refined, like that. And there will be more bulk points. This is actually a pretty focus. If you make more than short-range bulk, then you have more then you have more bulk points than boundary. So of course, not all these are independent. So that's the interesting thing, that we want a theory which looks like, if you act on the ground state by some operators like this, or some operators like this, or with a small number of them, they all look like independent. But when you have higher density, you start to find, oh, actually, they are not independent. There is no local constraints. And only if you satisfy all these conditions, then they map to some state on the boundary. In other words, if you look at, forget about the problem that the ground state has to be entanglement between these qubits, forget about that for a moment. If you think about a model with these qubits in the bulk, but actually what you have is a Hamiltonian that only acts on the boundary, and you map that to the bulk. What happens is these qubits looks like every site you have an independent qubit, but actually some of the states never show up. And you can think that as like that configuration has infinite energy. So there are all these non-local constraints, which is just an explicit realization of this holographic principle. It says that the number of degree of freedom is proportional to the area rather than volume. But I'm going to go to more details of that.
So a different question. It's hard for me at this angle to read exactly what you wrote on the board, but you talk about this low energy sector being spanned by product states. Is that not the whole Hilbert space? I would have thought that the span of product states is usually the entire space.
So as I said, actually these states, when you view them on the boundary, they're not even orthogonal to each other. Because the number of them is bigger than the whole Hilbert space. But it's possible that when I look at all of them, they actually span the whole Hilbert space. So what I call low energy subspace may contain everything. That's a problem of there's a difference from the Lagrangian basis.
It's checking the Ryu-Takayanagi formula, so that's non-linear in the state.
Yeah,
so
that's
I understand that. But there was a comment about the linear span, and I just wanted to keep track of it.
So maybe I should comment, because so for us, I know we sort of called it the low energy subspace, but what we really meant was the no black hole subspace, because you can get a very high energy state just by putting a perturbative quantum out near the boundary, and we wanted to include those. So I guess here you somehow seem to be in the opposite limit, where not only does the low energy subspace contain all of the boundary states,
no, they don't have to contain all the boundary states.
So
I just mean I don't have a proof that they don't contain all the boundary states. So they may contain all the boundary states.
But when you say low energy, do you have in mind sort of perturbative fluctuations about ADS, or can I have like some back reaction that doesn't form a black hole, or can I have a black hole? What is
so low energy compared to what? Okay, so what I call low energy subspace is like a cold subspace for Hamiltonian, except I'm talking about black space or not. So it's like I put a so let me be more precise. So I cannot define isometry from all these points, all the boundary. So I can only define a subset of points, isometry from the subset of points to other boundary. For example, I can take, let's take that single site. So I fix all other sites to zero, and then I can do anything on this side. Then there is an isometry from this in going arrow to the boundary. I can explicitly show that. I can draw the arrows like this, everywhere. And then I draw the arrow this way. Okay, so that's like a choice. Like, I can define an isometry. Yeah.
Are you saying that there's a flat space limit, which is just a square lattice?
Yes.
Why don't you just study that?
I'm studying that. I'm calling it sub-ADS, but actually I'm just studying the
flat
space.
same
problem.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Nice question. So when you went from the coarse grain tiling to the fine grain tiling, was that just you added lines by hand, or was there a procedure to go
No, I'm
one
just
to
the other? Rather defining the refined one.
So you just added more lines by hand.
Yeah, I'm just defining a new tensor network. So now let's just focus on the flat spaces. The explicit calculation we have done is for that case. Let me explain what is the calculation. So basically, this is an isometry from the one to the other one to the boundary. And if you have two, that's still fine. So I can flip these arrows, and that defines an isometry from these two to the boundary. So as long as you choose some red points, not too many, and there is an isometry from the bulk to the boundary, then all these operators are physical. They have a boundary correspond, and they are corresponding to something on the boundary which is not unique, but all these are physical operators. But if I choose too many and I don't have my isometry anymore, these operators are just not physical. They got mapped to zero when you map it to the boundary. So what I call low energy subspace is, maybe I should call low energy operators. Okay, low energy operators are operators which act on a set of points such that the set of points has an isometry to the boundary. So in other words, sorry, Benny, you have something.
Well, I just, surely you're not going to say that the Hamiltonian is local and the boundary, you're not.
No, I didn't. I don't have a Hamiltonian, so I don't know what
it is. Unless you have the notion of low energy.
Yeah, that's right. So it's just a notion of low income.
Yeah.
So this is like, yeah, it's like a kinematic discussion. It's like what are the, so basically I think the key thing we want to figure out here by looking at this square lattice is in what sense this theory, which actually has only four L qubits in the new basis, so the red line, looks like something in the low density, it looks like a theory with more. That's the key thing, right? So you seem to have locality. Like every point in the bulk, I can define some space there, I can define some operator there, and they all look like independent. And that's because like I can choose any two points and do this. Like on the square, I can choose any two points, and I can always find that isometry. So basically, think of this as like instead of this holographic code where you define a particular isometry from this, all the bulk points to all the boundary points, I define a family of code. Which are defined from a set of points to the boundary. So you have different.
And the number is proportional to the area for any given region.
Or? Yes, it has to be. Otherwise, you can't define that function. So actually, we have an algorithm that can explicitly find out how many configurations are involved. And I think this is a measure of something like a gravitational interaction between them, which means that they look in a very dilute limit, they all look independent. But when you try to throw in more things, and then the argument is that they become black holes, so the total entropy cannot exceed the area law. But what the counterpart of that in this model is you count what are the allowed configurations, like this is an allowed configuration, and then you increase the density and so on, and then you find that there are more and more configurations which are not allowed. So, for example, there is I can draw some configuration, and it's allowed. And then, if you draw another configuration like this, and that's not allowed. So you can figure out some rules. And basically, if you occupy four corners of anything like this, it's not allowed. So,
sorry, what do these circles represent?
It means that I put everything else into the zero state, and then I'm using this as input of the code, which means that basically it's like I want to calculate multi-point function on these points, in which case the multi-point function is something physical on the boundary, is when I say it's allowed.
So the difference with happy is that your mapping is allowed to use the fact it didn't use the fact that most of these are zeros.
Yes, because I have this property.
So you need both properties 2 and 3.
Yeah. So I use the property 2 for the state for the dots that are not red, and I use property 3 when this set is red. So you need to use this as an input using property 3. So the difference from the happy case is if you don't have this condition, then you have to just draw every intersecting line. So now I don't. Now I can just fix this and then use it as a four-leg tensor in the plane.
Oh, so it's important that your product state be one of those bases.
Yes.
So if the circles are very far apart, then is it basically just a question of counting the total dimension?
Yes, so basically,
the boundary dimension, then you start having inconsistent.
Well, of course, you will get a problem before you reach the boundary dimension. But you have problems before that, like if you have this thing, they are already forbidden.
Is there a local relation to each other in the network?
They're not local relation.
That's why I said just take them far apart.
Yeah, so even if they are far apart, I mean, even if it's very dilute,
yes,
if you occupy four corners of a rectangle, it's not going to be allowed. That's the key thing. I mean, you don't want all the requirement, all the rules to be just local repulsion of the point, right? It's not local rule, but it must be not local because when you increase the size, the degree of freedom that's forbidden is increasing because what you left is the area law. So the interesting thing is we calculate this as a probability to show this probability principle. We calculate this ratio. My student Chao found some very interesting algorithm to do that. So basically A and L is the number of configurations that is allowed for L by L squared. If you exact endpoints. And B and L is just a combinatorial number, which is like L squared. And like you have that many configurations, some of them are forbidden. And this ratio is basically 1 at the beginning. It's exactly 1 if the number n is smaller than 3. But bigger than 4, it's almost 1. And then it drops quickly to 0. And it's rigorously 0 if for n equals to 2L, it's rigorously 0. Which is almost what we expect. Because for n equals to 2L, every set there is d squared. So the dimension is d squared times 2L, which is the boundary rigorously estimated. So that tells you that for n bigger than 2L, it's certainly forbidden. But the interesting thing is somehow for n equal to 2L, it's also forbidden, which I don't quite understand why. But the maximal configuration that's allowed is 2L minus 1. So you're missing two qubits for every of the codes. I don't know why. Actually, maybe it's simply just because by construction we have some error calculation correction property, so it might be some issue. Maybe it's some reason. But since I'm running all the time, and there is a barbecue. So I think this picture is showing, okay, so let me also draw what is A itself. So if I draw a log of A, it's going like that. And the B is like something like that in that picture, and then A is going like that. There's more and more constraints, and then it suddenly drops to here. So I think that one property of this construction, which I think is a positive thing, is the low energy operators, which are so-called allowed, does not form a closed algebra. So I can choose a configuration which is allowed, and then I can apply any operator on it. So they form a complete, they form an algebra. You can multiply any operator on it. But then you have another configuration. Which is also, say, you have another, maybe this, you have another configuration which is also allowed. And then they form a subalgebra. But they together don't form a subalgebra. So if you create these, add these, you put them together, then you exceed the limit, and then you get something that doesn't have a boundary correspondence. But I think this is something you should get. Because, like, I can create many low energy excitations in the bulk. Each of them looks okay, and then you move them together, you form a black hole. So you don't want the low energy subspace to be low energy operators to form a closed algebra.
Do they form an algebra from the boundary point of view? I mean, the first.
For each choice, they do.
For each choice, you get an algebra.
Yeah.
And you can map that entire algebra to the boundary Hilbert
right,
space.
Right. We do a subalgebra.
And then I could multiply them there.
Yeah.
And I could ask the question, do all members of the algebra generated in the boundary by multiplying together these two boundary algebras have some representation in terms of the bulk?
If you only multiply things in that particular choice, right. There's no problem. If you multiply them together,
yeah.
you will generate something that's...
That you can prove has no bulk representation?
You probably by counting.
I think you can probably show it doesn't correspond to any one of their choices, but maybe superposition of them.
Yeah.
It doesn't have this type.
bulk graph.
It will not be represented by a certain definite number of points, yeah. That I understand. Yeah. It could still be a more general bulk.
If you do that, like if you multiply many, like many choices, yeah. Many of the configurations, and if you do arbitrary thing, I would expect that you can, that corresponds, you can do anything on the boundary. And then constantly you can create a black hole. And when you create a black hole, that means I want that to mean that you have to use all the d to the 4 degree of freedom and get a random state in the hole. But actually, as I said earlier, in general, I'm not sure if you have this and this and you take arbitrary superpositions of them, if that already contains all the states. Right? Maybe a particular problem of that Eulerian theory where you really need this higher random state in the higher.
So one thing that I liked about that we have is that if you made a black hole somewhere, outside of the black hole, the bulk algebra was all perturbation, you know, perturbations was all working fine. So can I see that here so that I can sort of get into trouble locally on the lattice, but then if I look at what's going on over here, I can still have everything commuting the right way?
I think so, because I can. Yeah, you what I correspond to the black hole here will be saying I just take that pentagon and then having split each of them into many points. And then if you have a black hole, which means say everything here is in a random state.
Yeah.
And then that's the same as you remove that part and call that random state, that's the same as your face.
Okay,
good. So then I can discern it, like for anything here, I can feel pretty long.
Okay, so it's the same.
So maybe the last thing I want to mention is, because we try to refine this, so of course you hope, like because you refine the lattice, so you're going to continue limit, you hope you restore all the nice symmetry to the continuum limit. But that's not transparent here, because I sort of, I mean, there's this curvature center, and so it's not smooth. So as a consequence, if you calculate neutral information of different boundary regions, so it just figures as a boundary, then say this thing and this thing, there is no neutral information, or this thing has no neutral information or anything like that. So according to Rutak and Nagy, we shouldn't have neutral information. But there are special choices here, like this, where you do have mutual information. And because the geodesics are like this, and I cannot shrink them anymore. So I get a tensor like this. So I think, but what may happen, it seems to happen numerically, but I'm still, they're still checking that. But what may happen is, If this tensor, like you make this transfer matrix by these tensors, if that transfer matrix has a spectrum without a gap, then this new information will tell you there is a gap which grows with n. Because what I call n is this grid. L is like the grid divided by the Planck constant. So when you increase that, yeah.
That transfer matrix is not a unitary operation?
In general, it's not unitary. Well, it's unitary if you take from here to here. But what I show up if you calculate the mutual information here is this transfer matrix, which is everything here is complex conjugation of these. So you take this double tensor, like this product with this complex conjugation, contract these lines, which come from converging everything else, and then you look at whether that's unitary. But it's not unitary. It's actually very far from unitary. So what happens is it has a spectrum. Well, you can show that there's always an even vector with the eigenvalue 1 by contracting these lattices to get identity. So but then there's sub-leading ones. So as long as there is a finite gap, then when you look at the transfer from here to here, this gap will be multiplied by n because you're doing many times. So it doesn't explicitly give you a large n limit, scaling dimension gap, but I think that there is a clear calculator which check whether there is a gap. There is a gap which increases. So it's possible that it does give you some WDS in that sense.
So I would have thought that if you want to have get rotational symmetry back, that you need something more like a random lattice.
Exactly, like a crystal structure.
You want something more like a glass where the links are sort of randomly connected, so there's no overall.
Exactly. I think the only way to restore the rotation and all the other symmetries, conformal symmetries, is probably by random lattice. But I don't know how to really calculate that.
Because it's difficult to look locally positively curved.
Yeah, so you want to randomly do it and without any positive curvature.
This property that your low energy subspaces has dimension, that's the square root out of the total dimension, 3 of the b to the 4th of the b squared. Is that something that would be preserved with other reconstructions, or is that something special?
It has to be like that if I define it like this.
Yeah, but because of the number of legs, I can. But if I would have some other type of lattice, then these numbers would change.
There's one possibility I can imagine is I can reduce that number, and then consequently, if I use a subset of that, then there are more points which are independent. So one limit maybe I can increase the bound dimension b, and make that constant which is not increasing, and then they are all independent. I don't know if that limit is more like the ESCLP case. It's like I have the box fields which are continuous fields, and then the number of people not grow within, but the boundary grow within. I'm not sure. So the question is whether, when I take the margin limit, compare it with the gauge theory case, is it just increasing that number? Or do I also want to increase the boundary?
Yeah,
this sounds awfully much like some sort of discretization of a topological field theory. Doesn't it feel like that?
Right.
Well, because all the excitations are really on the boundary.
Yes.
And has this vast gauge symmetry in the bulk.
So I'm not sure if it's related to topological field theory, but it is, I think it is some general phenomena that shows up in injective types. But injective types probably means it's topological trivial. But anyway, it's like a,
there is no theory unless there's a boundary, and at least there are no states unless there's a boundary. It does sound awfully topological.
Yes. But somehow all these things are like you are doing a particular choice, and that doesn't sound topological anymore. But somehow
you do have local operators. In topological theory, you don't have local. Here you do have local operators.
So one important thing I forgot to mention is. We said earlier that there is no local operator in the bulk. So what do we mean by these operators that looks like local operators in the low energy subspace? They are not really local operators because they only works if you all other points are fixed to that particular value. So these operators, if it looks local in the low energy subspace, they are actually product with all other sites projected to particular space. That's why they are kind of local. And you actually don't need all these projections because there is this causal wedge. So say if I have an operator here, you actually only need to project these things to zero when you use that wedge. So the real gauge invariant thing is this small gauge transformation. So this thing by itself is not gauge invariant because this choice is not linear. So it's really the gauge orbit of that, which is consistent with what I said earlier, that all the operators that are physical are defined under the bounding boundary.
Can I view that gauge orbit as being like you conjugate that by a gauge transformation?
Yes, I conjugate that by all gauge transformations. But I don't know what the content is.
But in topological theory, you don't even have that, right?
In topological
there's no analog of an operator which is local in this sense in a topological theory, is there?
Well, some lines.
I don't think so.
So there's more degrees of freedom here than in, or quasi-local or something, than in a topological theory.
Well, I think you can map the boundary degree of freedom to a degree of freedom to a boundary of 1 plus 1 maps to a topological theory in 2 plus 1. And but that doesn't give you this particular representation of the operator, which looks like local in a choice of frame.
When I think about flat space in a real theory of quantum gravity,
the key thing that I expect to see is something called the scattering matrix, right? There's a special unitary transformation that, you know, that's what characterizes the boundary correlation functions.
Sorry, the scattering matrix is between...
Between the past boundary of the conformal boundary and the future.
So these can be
boundary.
Some matter field or something.
Yeah, right. Okay. So I don't see anything in what you're doing that sort of, you're sort of talking about states at a fixed time.
Exactly. So that's the next question, which is how do I think about dynamics?
Yeah.
Then we first need to define how.
Unlike ADS, where we know the CFT has states at a fixed time because the ADS boundary is time-like. In the flat space case, there is no section like that, and there's a scattering matrix.
Does BFSS have states at a fixed time?
At a fixed light cone time.
It's
on the boundary.
It's a very interesting question. Even if I'm drawing the flat one, I'm still thinking of the flat space with the boundary. So it seems to make sense. But if I really have a flat space without any boundary, the hidden space without boundary, then what is the definition of the state? I still have the red points and every point. What is the definition of the cubic space? And I think this is a very interesting question.
Well, for flat space, I think we know the answer. It's the Hilbert space of scattering states. And there are two of them, because the conformal boundary is not a smooth manifold. And there's a map between the past and the future. And
so
that's
the
general
power diagram like this.
That's right. And so there are states defined down there, and another state defined up here, and a unitary map between those two Hilbert spaces, That's the key object that.
Well, wouldn't Andy say that they are sort of both all living, everything is in the Hilbert space, the spatial infinity?
No, they're tied together. The map is defined by boundary conditions of spatial infinity.
I have difficulty understanding what is happening here because, I can see that they're unitary mapping from the past infinity to the future infinity, if they're unitary evolutions gradually. But all these things are gauge equivalent, right? So I'm not really thinking of.
You have to make a gauge choice to make sense of that slicing. There are particular choices that pick out particular slicing. But the gauge invariant information is this map between the infinite past and the infinite future.
But by the way, I didn't say it, but I'm done. This is the question.
So I'm wondering if this is also a question for Daniel. Do these considerations of this type help resolve this question that Joe and I asked a good number of years ago, Nicholas Tumbas, about what happens and how you understand perturbations that take place in the bulk, which don't show up in an observable way on the boundary for a time?
Yes.
The thing that don't show up on the boundary forever?
No, they don't show up on the boundary for a certain amount of time. The perturbations of some sort in bulk, which take a time.
So I can't tell you, I don't know the dynamics, so what I can...
No, I know,
I can tell you.
Is there a kinematics?
I can tell you how to make one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's probably the same. I mean, I understand it better in our thing, I guess, but you just... You can act with operators in the dangling legs in the center.
Yes.
And those map to very non-local operators in the CFT.
Yeah, which is
and so I can just act with. I mean, so I can if I so for example say right. say that you know say that you may be acted with phi in the center. Well, I can push phi dot out to the boundary and measure it, and I'll see.
What I care about is not that they're non-local operators in the boundary. I want to make sure that they're not observable in terms of local operators.
Yes, but you have that because an operator that acts on different the operators that act on different dangling bulk legs commute with each other. So you can think of the sort of low dimension local operators at the boundary as being like the last leg of the last layer of dangling bulk legs.
Say that again.
So we can order the bulk legs radially going out.
Yeah.
Okay. And now roughly what I want to say is that by the extrapolate dictionary, the low dimension, you know, local primary operators are made, you can think of those as being operators that act on the final layer of the bulk dangling legs. Mm-hmm. And then I can push them out to local operators in the boundary. And those will all commute with the operators on the sites in the center by construction. So you can't tell if you acted with the one inside by measuring the ones out near the boundary.
In other words,
By measuring the local operators.
In other words, if you apply an operator here,
yeah,
and then look at any region on the boundary like this, the reduced matrix is completely the same as
You can't see it anywhere locally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the easiest way to say it, right? You can just push it out to the other side.
But I think the more material question is,
on the entire low-energy Hilbert space, they commute.
But somehow you can.
I mean, by measuring enough very high-dimension local operators, you can eventually figure it out.
Sure.
So
the commute
expectation value of the commutator is zero.
Yes, that's correct. In any of the low energy states, so it's very hard to tell that you have to perform these. I mean, this is actually slightly. It actually works too well because it shouldn't commute with the Hamiltonian, and that's the thing that we need to fix. But because it shouldn't commute with the stress tensor. But
I don't know. You said you can take some region like that and push it to the other side.
Yeah.
But that's not good enough. I want to make sure that.
So
what I said is better than that. So that's an easy way to see that for any particular local operator, it's going to commute.
For any particular, yeah, but yeah. I know, but we want but products no, all around. You know, we don't want things to show up.
Yeah. So it will commute with. Within the code subspace, it will commute with any combination of the local operators on that last boundary bulk layer.
So if you have an operator, you can have multiple points, but they have to be restricted to a region. If it's valid everywhere, I don't think that there is any statement that you can't see it on the boundary.
No, I just want to perturb one thing at the center.
Yeah, the other statement is that you can't see it on boundary because
that was the whole point of the error correction is you want to find a way to have that guy commute with all the local operators in the boundary in some sense.
But I think the natural thing in Lenny's question is why it becomes detectable later in time.
Well, that's the part I can't answer.
Our puzzle was why isn't it detectable?
We can explain.
That question is answered.
Although, as we discussed before, there's a remaining part to this that you would also expect based on bulk locality that these bulk operators are sort of string-like or surface-like operators that are highly non-local off the boundary. And that's not clear why it works. Either.
Yeah, that's what I'll find people.
Which operators? Sorry.
Oh, suppose you're in ADS3.
Yes.
And there's an operator that basically creates a string or a D1 during the boundary.
Right.
And you would expect, at least at leading order and large end, that based on bulk locality, that your local operator here also commutes with that thing.
It's better, I think.
And these kinds of stories give no reason to expect.
I see.
No obvious reason to expect.
Why do I expect that they commute with that?
It's a feature of the bulk theory.
I think you do kind of have that because
isn't that a very high energy operator?
I think it commutes also with that because the graph gives an isometry from the bulk legs to the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And that operator I would want to describe as some non-local operator on the last layer of bulk legs.
Yeah.
And that's still going to commute. So that's an operator that acts within the code subspace and will commute with this one in the center.
If I think of it as living one step in the bulk instead of on the boundary.
That's right. And I need to do that because if you look at the boundary local things, that includes very high dimension operators.
I think there are people who want to go to the boundary.
Have you dismissed the entanglement people that play soccer? Gravity people in my state, let's thank Shelly.